Okay, so I guess we should get started. So I'm James Cheney. I'll be one of the two lecturers for this course. This course is on logic programming. If this isn't the course that you think is taking place here, then you can go now, but hopefully you're all here for logic programming. So I'm one of the two lecturers for the course. The other is Alan Smale, and I'll be teaching the programming-oriented parts of the course, and Alan will be teaching the theory and sort of logic parts of the course. I'll be teaching the first two lectures this week, and then Alan will teach two lectures next week, and then we'll alternate from then on. So, what is logic programming? I just want to start today with a quick overview of what the course is about. And so logic programming is one of several programming paradigms. You probably have heard of object-oriented programming like C++, Java, or functional programming like Haskell or ML. And unlike a lot of other programming paradigms, logic programming has a somewhat different philosophy that's called a declarative philosophy. And the idea is that instead of a program being like a recipe that the computer is supposed to blindly follow step by step and often make mistakes step by step, instead of being like a recipe, a program should be like a specification or a description of what the problem you want solved is. And you describe the problem, and the computer or the logic programming implementation is going to go off and search for an answer for you. So the sort of dream of this approach, which was, summarized in a paper 20 or 30 years ago by a guy named Rob Kowalski, who was actually here at Edinburgh at the time, is that we can decompose algorithms, that is sort of thinking about the problem you want to solve, into logic, that is a declarative way of describing problems, and a control strategy for searching for solutions. So the advantage of that being hopefully that the programmer doesn't really have to think too hard or know too much about how the implementation is working, and can sort of save a lot of effort re-implementing common search strategies or common programming techniques. So unfortunately, this idea really kind of only gets you so far, and things like input and output or interaction with the outside world, concurrency, even basic things like arithmetic, wind up needing kind of an imperative treatment in a logic programming language, or at least a treatment that kind of breaks the abstraction of declarative programming that we sort of want. So for efficiency, or to make sure that your program terminates, often you actually do need to know what the search strategy is and how to control the system so that it doesn't go off and do something that takes forever or takes a very long time. But still, there are advantages to the declarative approach. So Prolog is, I wanted to point out on the first slide I mentioned, there's a difference between logic programming, the programming paradigm, and Prolog, which is a particular logic programming language, and it's probably the best known of these languages. And it's, again, dates back 30 years or so. And Prolog has a core that's based on first-order predicate logic, as you might have seen in previous courses on logic or discrete mathematics. But it is based on an algorithmic realization of proof search based on techniques called first-order unification and depth-first SLD resolution. In order to get a living, breathing programming language that you can use to write programs that interact with the outside world, you do need to have additional layers on top of this pure core that let you do certain things. So there's the dream, and then there's the reality as it's implemented in Prolog. So why learn logic programming? Well, maybe if you're taking this course, you've already decided why you want to learn it, and maybe the reason is that it's required for another course you want to take. But even if that's not the case, why learn it? Well, I think that logic programming is actually often a great way to at least start to learn about a problem space or an algorithm, particularly in areas like symbolic computation or natural language parsing, where there are really often the features that you want for certain kinds of problems come built in right with the language. And on top of that, declarative ideas really arise and keep cropping up in lots of different areas of computer science. So logic programming is a good thing to know about so that you know when you're reinventing one of the wheels that was already invented in Prolog. In particular, in artificial intelligence, natural language processing, also in databases and programming languages, ideas from logic programming, even though the particular syntax or approach in Prolog isn't always used, a lot of the same ideas are reused. Also, the idea of declarative programming crops up quite often in techniques that are becoming popular nowadays, or have become very popular in the last 10 years in hardware verification, in software model checking. The idea is you describe the, say, the set of states of a model that you want to check are reachable or unreachable, and the system can go off and try and solve the problem for you. So I guess also more recently, there's been some work in program analysis and a lot of work in the semantic web techniques for querying or for reasoning about resources online using rules actually draw on techniques from logic programming. So I claim that even though you may not be able to earn a huge amount of money writing Prolog every day, you might find these ideas useful in other areas, even if your interest is primarily in going into industry and not in computer science research. But I also think that learning a fundamentally different way of thinking about problems or a way of thinking about programming can make you a better programmer, or at least I think it helped me become a better programmer when I learned it. So maybe that will be true for you, maybe it won't. So let's see, how is the course going to be organized? I mentioned at the beginning that we have two lectures. I'll be lecturing, giving the lectures on the programming component, and Ellen Smale will be giving the lectures on the theory component. So the theory component will be covering first-order logic and its semantics and things like Herbrand models, so models based on term data structures, and the key mathematical elements that provide the semantics of logic programs. And also we'll be discussing at a sort of rigorous level the ideas behind unification and proof search in Prolog. I'll be in the programming stream of the course, first starting with the rest of the lecture today, giving just sort of showing you how do you actually get started with Prolog and how do you make it work, how do you make small programs work, and sort of scaling up to more interesting programs. And then once we've got a basic foundation, going and looking at a bunch of different application areas like techniques in search in artificial intelligence, or techniques for parsing, or symbolic processing, sort of expression, rewriting types of programs. Okay, so again, the way the course is organized, you probably already know, basically the lectures are today, Mondays and Thursdays at 3 p.m., and as I mentioned right at the beginning, the first 2 weeks will be, I'll be giving the first two lectures, and then I'll be out of town next week, and Ellen will give the second two lectures. And then after that, we'll alternate with the theory lecture being on Monday and the programming lecture being on Thursdays. We'll be skipping a week of lectures sometime in the middle. I think right now, tentatively, that's November 1st. That might change to a week earlier, but I'll nail that down probably by Thursday. Also, there will be tutorial sessions that might sort of alternate between more discussion of problems and more sort of labs where we work, or where the group breaks into smaller groups and works on problems interactively. Those will be, I think, all over upstairs in AT 5.07, but double check in case I misread the schedule. And those are, I'll get into it in a second, but those are actually recommended because that's a good way for you to find out how well you're following what we're saying, and for us to find out whether we need to pay more attention to particular topics. And the slides and tutorial problems will be posted as we go on the course webpage. The tutorials will also not start for a couple of weeks, so we'll announce that again closer to the time they start. Okay, so this is a 10-point third year undergraduate course, and there's no formal coursework during the semester, but as I said just now, Participating in the tutorials is strongly encouraged. The tutorial exercises, both the theory and the programming exercises, are fairly representative of the kinds of problems you see on the exam, so you won't be as taken by surprise if you follow along. And the way the grading works, the final exam, there is two components. There's a programming component and a theory component that are weighted equally. So both undergraduate third-year students and master's students are enrolled in this course, and there's a different level for passing the course. So the undergraduate students need 40% combined between the two exams, and master's students need slightly higher, 50%. Okay? So I think that's it for the course organization and overview. So I just want to stop if anybody has a quick question or if I've confused anything. No? Okay, good. So now for the rest of the first lecture, I'll just be giving an overview of how to get started with Prolog and what are the basic concepts and how does syntax work. And I'll probably start the interpreter up and try and put some examples in and probably make some syntax errors, and you can laugh. That'll be good. I should have said also, so there's a course webpage. All the information is on the course webpage. Okay, so we're going to use an implementation of Prolog called Sixtus Prolog that the university has a site license for, so it's free for all of your use, and it's loaded on all DICE machines. And you can also request a copy that will run on Windows through Windows support. I actually have a Mac. You can request a copy, I think, that will run on a Mac just like the one I've got running on mine, through support also, but I haven't done this in a year or so, so I'm not quite sure who to ask. Let me know if you have problems getting access to the Mac version. Also, it's important to point out that all the exams and tutorial sessions will be using the DICE machine version, and so it's worthwhile to make sure that you know. I mean, I'm sure you all already do know, but it's worthwhile to make sure you know how to use, you know, Emacs or another text editor of your choice to write programs on a DICE machine and run them using the official version that you'll be using on the exam, just to avoid any last-minute confusion. Okay? So there's also extensive online documentation for this Prolog implementation. You really shouldn't need to read very much of it. The manual is about 1,000 pages. Don't start reading it all the way through. The only reason you might want to read it is if there's something about some predicates or built-in functions that I explain in class in an unclear way. But really, probably the easiest thing to do is to just ask me or ask at the next lecture. Okay, so now to make the lecture a little bit more interactive. So here's a very simple program. I've just started the interpreter on my system, and I'm going to print something. So this, believe it or not, is already a program. It's a very short program. And basically what's happening here is, so I started the interpreter just by, you know, typing the Unix command name. And beyond some sort of version number gobbledygook, basically what I get is this question mark dash, which is a prompt that's asking for input. So it's an interpretive language, and so you have a sort of standard read, evaluate, print loop, like in a language like Lisp or Haskell. And so basically this is saying, give me something to do. So one thing you can ask that is to use a built-in primitive called print and give it a string here, and it will print it, right? So none of this should be rocket science, I hope. And the main thing I want to point out is that this is somewhat different from what you might see in a language like C or Java or even Haskell, in that this is basically saying, here's a goal that I want you to solve. And the goal that I want you to solve is basically to go and print something to the screen. Okay? So the key sort of syntactic difference is that instead of having a semicolon at the end like you might see in an imperative language, you have a period. And the point of that is, or a full stop in British English, and the point of that is to say, this is like a sentence, like in logic, this is a statement. And of course, the fact that this sentence is now having a side effect is kind of breaking the abstraction a bit. But the point is that the things that you type into the prompt line in Prolog are called goals. And the meaning is that you're telling the system, go and solve a problem for me and come back when you find an answer. Okay? Okay, so in this case, the solution is that in going off and finding an answer, the system prints some information out, as you can see, and then it comes back and says, yes, I found an answer. I successfully printed. Okay? So in particular, there wasn't any, we posed a goal that didn't have any extra information that the system could come back and give us to tell us what kind of the solution it found. We told it everything about what it was supposed to do. Okay. Right, so this is an output of this statement, and this is a response from the interpreter saying that I found an answer. Okay? Right, so diving in a bit into syntax, there's one other thing I forgot to say. I think I was going to say it at the end, but I'll mention it now and say it. So there's a course textbook. It's called Learn Prolog Now. And there's a free version online. There's a link to it in the slide handout. And the slide handout will be posted online shortly in case you didn't get one, because I think I didn't make enough. Okay? So there is a textbook, and everything I'm going to talk about today comes from chapter one of that textbook. Chapters one and two, I think. Okay, so how does the syntax go? So in Prolog, the syntax is mostly built up of things called atoms. So an atom is basically any kind of string or sequence of alphanumeric characters, usually starting with a lowercase letter, or it could be starting with an uppercase letter or number or something like that, provided it's enclosed in single quotes. So things like, you're probably all familiar with The Simpsons, people like Homer and Marge and Lisa and Bart, their names can be atoms. People like Mr. Burns, his name starts with a capital letter, so it has to be enclosed in quotes here. And similarly, Principal Skinner has a space in it, needs to be enclosed in quotes. But basically, atoms can be arbitrary strings. Okay, so so for example, here I've basically just said, okay, I haven't explained what capital X is, but I will in a second. So basically, I've said, here's an atom, Mr. Skinner, and I want you to solve the goal where the solution is X is equal to the atom, Mr. Skinner. And this has gone off and solved it. I'm going to make this bigger, too. Okay. So right, as I just said, this x on the in the example I gave is called a variable, and basically, much like atoms, variables can be arbitrary sequences of characters, but the convention is that usually a variable starts with a capital letter, so a capital X, capital Y, capital Z, and so that's sort of a convention that's built into the language. So that's why you need to, if you want an atom, if you want to write an atom that starts with a capital letter, you need to put it in quotes to prevent confusion with variables. So basically, a variable is a symbol that isn't necessarily known at the time you write it down and might later get bound to some other symbol, maybe an atom or maybe a more complicated term. Okay. So, yes?
How do you declare a variable without a value?
Well, that's a good question. There's actually no need to declare variables in Prolog. You can sort of think of variables mentioned in goals as being free variables that could be instantiated with anything. There's also no real type system, so you don't need to worry too much about types until you start writing big programs, in which case you need to be careful about types. But hopefully that will be clearer as we go, how these things are used. Right, so that's an important point, though. These are not necessarily the same kinds of variables as you would see in a language like Java or C or Haskell, in that you can use a variable without necessarily knowing what its value is yet. And there might be more than one value that could match a particular variable name. Also, you can't set a value to a variable to a value and then change its value later. It's going to be kind of more like a functional language in that respect if you remember, that functional languages don't allow you, often don't allow you to update the values of variables. Okay, so the third basic ingredient to the syntax is something called a predicate. So a predicate, we've already seen an example of a predicate in the print example right at the beginning. A predicate is an expression with the form P, where P is some atom, followed by a list of terms separated by commas, that the terms could be atoms, could be variables, and could be other things which I haven't explained yet. Okay, so let's just think of terms as being atoms and or variables for the time being. So for example, we might have a predicate that says Homer is Bart's father, and some a two-place predicate that describes a relationship between two atoms, in this case, Homer being the father of Bart or Marge being the mother of Bart, right? So we can have not just two arguments, but as many as we want. Okay, so just to break things down a little bit further, so a predicate has a name, which is the P component, this atom, and really that can be any atom. And it also has an arity, which is the number of arguments it takes. And as far as Prolog is concerned, the two predicates with the same name but different arity are different predicates. So there's sort of no confusion between a predicate with name foo, which takes one argument, and a predicate with name foo that takes two arguments. So there's a convention that if you are talking about predicates that might be used, about predicate names that might be used with different arities, that you write the predicate name and then a slash and then a number to say how many arguments it takes. So this is a common convention that you would see in the documentation, and which I'll be using in the slides pretty frequently. So I wanted to explain it now so that it isn't as confusing the first time you see it.
And question?
Yeah.
So
foo slash one here, so foo is an atom, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that you can have occurrences of predicates that use the same name, the same atom as a name, but are treated differently if they have different numbers of, this expression here, foo slash one, isn't actually a Prolog expression, it's just a kind of conventional notation. There are really the point is that the identity of a predicate involves both its name and its arity. I'm sorry if that's not quite answering your question, but hopefully it'll become so. Maybe I can just illustrate. I'm skipping ahead here, but basically. Sorry, I don't have a good example that illustrates that at the moment, but I'll get back to this if it's not clear. Okay, so moving on, what in Prolog a program consists of a set of assertions that describe a problem or describe a background knowledge about a problem, and so. There are two kinds of assertions, and one of them is called facts, and the other one is called rules, which we'll get to in the next slide. So a fact is an unconditional assertion that some predicate is true. So we saw a couple of examples earlier saying Homer is Bart's father, Marge is Bart's mother. And so a collection of facts is sometimes referred to as a knowledge base or database that sort of refers to basic information that you can always use for free. Okay? As I pointed out before, the common type of error is actually forgetting to put a period at the end of a fact or at the end of a rule. So you need to watch out for that. I always forget. Okay. So a goal we discussed before. I showed an example. A goal is a sequence of predicates. In this case, we'll talk about simple kinds of goals. that are conjunctive. So they're sequences separated by commas. So in prologue, the comma symbol can be read as a conjunction. That is, this goal holds, and that goal holds, and that goal holds. Okay? So also, I didn't really mention this, but predicates can be can take no arguments, in which case you leave off the parentheses. So there are some built-in predicates that basically constant propositions, such as true or false or failed. And false and fail basically say, just give up, there's no solutions. And true says there is a solution. So you don't really use these in programs very often, but they can be useful in kind of higher order programming settings. Okay. So now we all have all the basic ingredients to talk about Prolog's execution model. And this may get at the question of what variables mean and when their values get bound to when values get bound to variables. This will start to answer it. We'll be talking about this in more detail for the next several lectures. So the idea is that given a goal and maybe some underlying facts or other program clauses, other constraints, given a goal, the Prolog engine will search for answers that solve the goal. Okay? So, and answers can be either no, in which means that there isn't a solution, of course, or yes, and possibly with some extra information that tells you what the solution is like. That is, there could be variables in the goal that you give the system, and those variables could be bound to different values that would give you different answers. Okay? So the, yeah.
So if we get a no, we would never expect an output to get a no.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll be giving some examples of this in a second. I just want to explain the high level, what's going on at the high level first. So, right, when you get a yes answer, you might also get some additional information that tells you what the answer is like. And those are given in the form of substitutions. So the substitution being essentially a list of bindings, equations between variables, and maybe other more complicated terms. There might also be more than one solution. If there's no solutions, then you'll either get no, or maybe the system will run off into an infinite loop. But if there are solutions and the system finds them, then there might be more than one, and you can ask the system to show you additional solutions, to sort of iterate through all the solutions. Okay? Great. So so here are some little examples which I'll actually run here. So I've got a little file which I've put some random facts from the Simpsons universe in. And so if we ask, if I ask, find an X such that X is Bart's father, well, what should we get? Hopefully, if the data is any good, then we should get Homer back. And if I ask for more solutions, we shouldn't. Everybody has at most one father, at least biologically. And so we might also, let's see, we might also ask, show me X and Z and Y such that X is Z's father and Y is Z's mother, so which people have a child in common, right? And I've given the answers there, but just to convince you that this actually works. Here's how it goes. So if we run this, we'll get back one solution that binds X to Homer, so X is someone's father and that person is Z, Bart, which we got already. And also we know that Y is Marge. Marge is also the mother of Bart. Okay, so that's true, at least oops.
Can you start a program something like main?
Well, that's, since it's an interactive language, we don't really need to worry about that for the time being. What's happened in this program is earlier I loaded a separate file that contains a bunch of declarations in. And that's a common way of starting a program, is to load a file that has a bunch of declarations and then call some predicates in that file. You can actually write programs with a main function and tell the system to compile them into a program that you can run from the command line.
The functions father and mother are written by you?
Yes, but also they're not functions. They look like functions, but they're actually logical predicates.
Where did you define them?
I'll show you. Okay, so this is a separate file that contains a bunch of declarations. So, for example, we start out with some sort of classifications like which people are children and which people are male and female. And going down here, here are the declarations for the father predicate that I've just been using. And so they're it's basically just a list of these fact predicates. It so happens that I've written them one per line, but white space isn't important. What's important is that you have a predicate or another or something else that works as a basic clause followed by a period. Okay? Yeah. But yeah, so there's no main function in this. This is just a bunch of declarations of facts. Okay, so, right, that's, but are there any other questions before I go on? Okay. Right, so what I was in the middle of showing was that we can ask for the system to show us answers that match certain constraints. So in this case, we've asked for pairs XZ and YZ such that the second component is the same, drawn from the two different predicates, father and mother. So we've got one answer which we already sort of knew, which is that Homer and Marge are the parents of Bart, and also of Lisa, and also of Maggie, right? So, and then, that's not good. Oh, actually, there are other families in the database, and it will go through and find those relationships too. Yes. Yes, we'll get to that in about 5 or 6 weeks. Okay. But yes, I don't want to jump that far ahead. Okay, so, right. So far we've been talking about program statements, program clauses that basically just say some particular relationship exists between some particular atoms. And that's not really very powerful. You'd like to be able to write conditional relationships without necessarily knowing everything about the, without sort of specifying every individual relationship. So in particular, an example that you might like to be able to do is you might like to say that two people are siblings if they have a parent in common, right? So that example is at the bottom of the slide here. So you might say, okay, if X has Z as a parent and Y has Z as a parent, then they're siblings. We could make that definition. It's actually not quite right. We'll see an example of this in the moment. But this is just an example of what in Prolog is called a rule. So it's and this can be read as if the conjunction of predicates on the right-hand side of the rule all hold for some perhaps substitution of the free variables, then also the head of the rule, that's this thing, holds. So this part of the rule is often called the body, and this is often called the head. Okay. So also in logical terms, you can think of this as being sort of like, let me write it. Also write this rule as something like, in logical notation, and maybe you might even write an explicit quantifier that says that this is an implication that says that if all of these formulas hold for some values of x1 through xn, then this formula holds. So the Prolog notation is just a rearrangement of this kind of logical notation, but it turns out to be slightly more readable as a program, or at least that's the convention in Prolog. Okay. So, So I've got some little example rules in this file here, and basically what I've done is, well, here's the sibling rule, for example. X is a sibling of Y if they have a common parent Z. Okay, so let's load that in and see if it gives us reasonable answers. Okay, so we've loaded it, and let's see who is, which X's are siblings of Bart. Okay, well, actually the definition we gave is technically kind of wrong, because it also allows somebody to be their own sibling, right? So basically all the rule says is that there has to be some common parent Z, and of course you have the same parent as yourself. So this rule will always match, for example, Bart to assuming Bart has a parent, which we already saw he does in this database. This will always be able to derive that somebody that has a parent has his or herself as a sibling. That's not quite what we want, but we'll fix that later. I'm just using these to illustrate, using these examples to illustrate rules.
So when you use different letters for the variables, it doesn't imply that they are also different.
Exactly. Yes. That's exactly the case. So, in fact, I can let me make it drive the point home by saying this. So, which X's and Y's satisfy a sibling XY? So there's no constraint that two different variables, syntactically different variables, have different values. Okay. But just to show that the rule isn't completely broken, we do at least derive Lisa is a sibling of Bart, and Maggie is a sibling of Bart, and I guess we derive Bart as a sibling of Bart again, because the rule can apply in two different ways. But eventually we run through all the answers and we're done. Okay? Okay. So, right. So maybe you picked this up from the code examples I showed already, but just so that you know how things are. Comments are written either in a sort of C or Java style where you have /*, and then whatever you want within reason, and then */, or you can write a comment by starting a line with a percent sign. Okay, so this is, you could look this up, but it's good to just sort of point it out right away. And also to get out of the command line, the interactive loop, you can type exit, or you can just type Control-D, and, you can't type exit, whoops, okay. So you can type Control-D and you get out. But this really depends on the implementation. Right, so I showed an example of this already, but one of the basic things that you often need to do when writing or testing a program is you'll typically write the program as a separate file and then load it into the interpreter by using a predicate called consult. So consult says, go and take this file and read all of its clauses and declarations and load them into the system so that they'll be used by proof search. Okay? So,
I think you're using the square brackets.
Yeah, that's on the next slide, but let me just, I want to show the real syntax and then the shortcut syntax. So, instead of writing the square brackets, what I could have done is this. Okay, and this has the same effect as what I did before. But actually, if the name of the file that I'm loading in ends with the suffix .pl, that's the sort of default prolog file name suffix, then I don't need to add that suffix, so I can just do I can just do that, or I think I can also just do this. Okay, and finally, as some of you already noticed, maybe all of you already noticed, you can also, this bracket notation is just a shortcut for this consult predicate. So you can also just do that. Okay, so I've said the same thing in three or four different ways. And, you know, really the only, it's just, you know, it saves you five characters, but life's too short to write the whole thing out, I guess. So, okay, so that's how you load things in. Right, and so finally here we have a little complete program which has something that looks like a main function. It's not really a function, but something that if you, you could actually turn into a running program from the command line that would just print something out. It's not actually necessary for the purposes of this course to go into how to build programs that run, but if anybody wants to, just let me know and I'll point you to the instructions. I'll show you how to do it. Okay, but so the point is this has everything you need in it to do something. Whereas I think the Java version of Hello World is about 40 lines long, right? So, okay. So another thing I want to mention early and then we'll come back and use a few times throughout the course is there are some built-in facilities for tracing or debugging to watch what the system is doing as it's trying to solve a goal. Okay? So let me just give a few examples of this. So I've loaded the Simpsons stuff. Let me load. Actually, let me turn tracing on. Okay. And let me do this goal. That asks for people for Z's that have the same father X and for the father and the mother of Z. Okay, so evidently what this is going to do is first see if we can find a solution to the father goal. That's the first goal that we started trying to solve. And so we'll find a solution right away with X bound to Abe and Y bound to Homer. And then we want to look for the mother of Homer. So now we know, we've discovered through pattern matching against the father fact that Z is going to be Homer if the solution we're exploring is going to work out. So now we look around and we can't actually find the name of Homer's mother isn't stored in the data, so we're going to get stuck. So we're going to backtrack and say, okay, well, is there some other way we could solve this goal with Abe and Homer being in the father relationship? And we can't find any other ways, so we back up and we're going to look for another solution. Okay, so this whole search strategy is not something that I've explained yet. I'm just giving you sort of the flavor of what's going on, and we'll actually go into the details of what's going on as we go starting on Thursday and then in a couple of weeks. So we backtrack and we look for another solution. And the other solution we look for is going to be something we've now matched against the predicate father Homer Bart. So now we're going to look for, if we know who Bart's mother is, then we can find an answer. Okay, so we're looking to see if we can find out the mother of Bart, and we do actually find a solution for that, that's Marge. And now the system actually produces what it would have produced if we weren't tracing, which is the actual answer, okay? So this is tracing through basically one sort of reasoning step at a time. And if we want, we can still say, show me more answers, and it will essentially behave the same as if the answer that we just found had failed somewhere along the way and backtrack and try and find other solutions. So you can keep on going like that. I'm not sure off the top of my head what happens, how things, if the other debugging predicates allow you to set more like breakpoints or identify parts of the program that you want to know when they happen. And There's a lot more documentation on how to use the debugging features in the Sixtus Prolog documentation. I just wanted to point out early that these things are there so that you know they're there when they might come in handy.
Okay.
And you can turn debugging off like that. Okay, so I guess maybe I've run through a little quickly, but I guess I think we're supposed to stop at 3:50. So just before we wrap up, I wanted to point out again, so there's some getting started and background and further reading linked from the course webpage, and there's also an online version of this book, which you can read if you don't want to buy the book, but the book is actually not very expensive. I think you can get it for about 20-ish pounds on Amazon, but in any case, the online version is, you know, online and free. I think the only difference here is that the print book has answers to some of the exercises, which might be helpful for learning. There's also a standard textbook called Programming in Prolog, which I think the university library has many copies, if you want to have a look at that. Put a few little exercises in the notes at the end if you want to try what I've shown you out. And if you were paying attention, you might have seen the answers to these flip by on one of the code examples. There'll be similar sort of basic getting started types of exercises in the first tutorial session. Okay, so next time we'll be talking about more. A little bit more of the core language of Prolog and how the equation solving and proof search actually works. We'll be starting to talk about that. Okay? Yeah.
If you want some bunch of match to be like a function in C or something like that.
Sorry.
If you want some bunch of commands to be done, yeah. I mean, you need to do something like a function. What do you do?
Goals or clause bodies together using conjunction that will say solve all of these. And if the things that you're asking to solve have side effects, then the side effects will get performed, sort of like in C program, if you want things in order. But there are a lot of differences, so we'll get to those kinds of things. But it's a much different programming model.
Okay, thanks.
To take automated reasoning and knowledge modeling, would those courses use Prolog?
I don't think automated reasoning does, although I think there's some overlap in terms of the sort of logic components. I don't know what is in knowledge modeling, so you might want to ask the instructor of that. I mean, if it's listed as a requirement, then it probably does. But if it's not, then it probably doesn't need it.
Like you mentioned logical conjunction. How do we declare disjunction, negation?
We'll get there. Yeah.
I'm taking two courses in cognitive science.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I came here. You know, they're given, if you're taking courses in cognitive science, Prolog might be useful.
Mm-hmm.
Give me some suggestion on how we're all, you know, logic programming is used in the informatics courses here?
I actually don't know enough about all of the things on the more AI and cognitive science side, so I'm probably not the right person to answer the questions. I mean, I think the basic answer is if this course is listed as a prerequisite or as a suggested thing, then you probably need it, and if not, you can probably get along without it. But I'd have to suggest that you ask the people that teach the courses you're interested in.
Okay.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Mine was just where to go for the Mac version.
Yeah, so I got mine by asking the through the informatic support. Yeah, I think it might have been through ITO. It was a year ago, and I can't quite remember. But if you give me a minute, why don't I answer your question first, and then I can look it up.
I've been recently studying a little bit of constraint programming,
mm-hmm.
and well, it seems that there are a lot of similarities between
yeah.
these two. But actually, the reasoning that Prolog or any logic programming language uses for searching the algorithm for searching the answer,
mm-hmm.
Will probably be used in the constraint programming, but not only for the logic things. There are a lot of other stuff that can be used in constraint programming. So
yeah.
how can they get together?
Well, so one answer is there's something called constraint logic programming that is basically the idea is you have, what I showed before basically is looking at like equational constraints between
yeah.
terms in Prolog, and the terms are kind of uninterpreted.
Mm-hmm.
But you can also build in other constraint domains like real numbers
yeah,
or
exactly.
Or
I
boolean.
Mean, is
boolean.
It possible in Prolog? To do
that? Yeah, it is. Actually, there are constraint domains for like real and integer arithmetic and finite domain
okay.
constraint solvers built into Sixtus Prolog. There's
what about linear algebra? Or
Well, there isn't very much. So there's, linear arithmetic constraints, yes. I'm not sure about sort of abstract linear algebra constraints, but the whole constraint logic programming area is pretty big, so it could be that people have looked at it, but as far as I know, there isn't, you could expand out, real valued or complex valued linear algebra constraints into, so one of the nice things about constraint logic programming is you can sort of use the Prolog level features to define sort of the high level structure, and then emit a bunch of constraints, and then say, okay, specialized constraint solver, go and solve these constraints efficiently. So it's sort of a good combination.
The actual thing I'm looking for is a kind of framework that
mm-hmm.
can be used in everyday applications of constraint programming. Is that basically a Prolog based kind of languages, or no, there are kind of different frameworks?
Yeah, well, the...
I've seen a constraint programming platform for Java, but
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's the right thing.
Yeah.
There are a few of them, so...
I think the thing to do is to have a look around for constraint logic programming. It's really kind of an idea that is used in a bunch of different languages rather than there's not like a specific language that's all about it,
exactly.
but it's that there are parts that are incorporated into Prolog as libraries and things. Depending on what kind of constraints you're interested in, it might actually be possible to implement your favorite constraint domain as a sort of an add-on using things called constraint handling rules. There's sort of a standard formalism for defining new sort of little constraint domains, but the thing is though that actually we last year and probably this year also I had one lecture close to the end where I talked about constraint logic programming and gave some examples, but